Selected Shorts is supported in part by the loyal friends of Selected Shorts. To join, or for more information, visit selectedshorts.org.
These are city people, and they all know where they're going, taking fast steps, 1, 2, 3, 4.
This week on Selected Shorts, a jazz-inspired cityscape, and a Carson McCullers classic.
Nothing mattered much except playing the music as it must be played, bringing out the thing that must be in her, practicing, practicing, playing so that Mr. Bilderbach's face lost some of its urging look.
I'm Isaiah Sheffer, and you're listening to Selected Shorts, a series which brings together the best actors from Broadway and Hollywood to read great literature, old and new, in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. We think of this program as a literary mixtape, featuring two stories mingling with the music that inspired or played a role in them. Right now you're listening to trumpeter Brandon Lewis with David Frazier on drums and Michael Forzano on bass, playing Milestones by Miles Davis. This was the inspiration for Hannah Tinty's story of the same name, and we'll hear Milestones, the story, read now by the performance artist Laurie Anderson.
Down on the street, they're all trying to cross at once. It's a hard, crisp fall day, and the people are crowded on the corner, eyeing the light. And when the yellow cab runs the red and angles itself in the crosswalk, they rush forward and split and divide around it like water. These are city people, and they all know where they're going, taking fast steps, 1, 2, 3, 4. And dodging around things in their way, like newspaper stands and lunch carts, grilling rows of chicken legs, and tourists with matching purple windbreakers looking up, and unshaven men on the steps of the church, crouched beneath statues, blankets over their heads and cardboard signs at their feet. Help me, I need help, please, anything. There's a double stroller coming in on the right. There's someone shouting Spanish into a payphone. There are watches for sale, and bags, and hats, and small plastic frogs swimming in water. Above all of this, the rope slips, and there he goes. One moment, red is his hand out, steadying as he pulls the squeegee down the side of the 27th floor window. Grinning is the secretary wearing the green blouse inside picks her nose, and the next he feels the roof braces shift, and one side of the scaffolding drops, and he's putting his heel down into nothing, into empty air. And the rest of him follows behind, like a string of beads falling off a table. Red has fallen before, off his own two-story home, tripped over the edge while reshingling, and landed on a small fir tree he'd planted 3 weeks earlier to symbolize the birth of a new baby, a girl, who'd come so early that her ears hadn't developed yet. They were just small openings with tiny flaps of skin above. She'd immediately been placed in an incubator, and that was where she was when Red fell off the roof, and that tiny plastic bubble, her ears just beginning to bend and fold. The tree collapsed underneath Red's weight, and he heard those branches snapping more than his leg, which came apart in three places. Now the floors whiz past him, 25, 26, 24, and Red is waiting for his safety line to catch. There's a harness across his shoulder, and underneath his arms, a large metal ring in the back for a rope to go through, and that rope should be stopping him now. Meanwhile, he's remembering how to fall, with his shirt flapping and his stomach sinking and his body turning and his hard hat gone. On the sidewalk, no one looks up, not even the tourists. They're busy moving around a truck that's taken a corner too quickly and knocked over the lunch cart that sells kebabs. Raw meat hits the gutter, and the owner is holding onto the side of his face, singed by his portable stove. A man breaks away out of the crowd and enters the lobby of the building. There's something special about him, the way he carries himself, as if he's determined to make good. He nods at the security guards, and they smile back. He turns into the narrow hallway, and there's an elevator waiting, already full of people. He steps in right before the door closes. There's a woman standing next to him, wearing a blue overcoat and smelling like lavender. The scent is coming from her hair. This man is going to quit his job today, a job he's worked at for 15 years, and soon he will never have to ride this elevator again. Last night, he ordered a gin and tonic at a bar, and when he tasted the lime, he suddenly remembered being in love when he was 22 with a girl he'd met working at a fish fry. Tall, slender, knock-kneed, her skin so pale it would change color when you touched it. On Mondays, the fish fry was closed, and he would pack food and a small thermos of gin and tonic, and they would go to the beach, stretch out on a blanket in the sun, and take turns reading short stories out loud and swimming in the icy water. It was, John remembered, a time when he was happy. And he was not happy now, living alone, reading Kierkegaard, and masturbating every night into a sock. Leaning against the bar, he caught a reflection of himself in the mirror above. There is no denying it, he was middle-aged. He lifted his fingers to his mouth as he swallowed the gin, as if he needed to push the alcohol farther down his throat. He remembered licking the girl's neck on the blanket, how salty it tasted. And he ran his tongue over his own wrist. All he felt was hair. He would change what he could. He would leave his job. In the morning, this made everything seem different. The sky was brighter, the colors people wore passed in a blur, and even when he stepped onto the elevator, he could sense it, a certain snappiness to things, to their possibility. John can't help himself. He starts to hum. Fascinating rhythm, you've got me on the go. The other people in the elevator exchange glances, try to move away from him, but there's no place to go. John does not care. In fact, so determined is he to change his life that he hums louder. Still, they are going up and up, and John's ears begin to pop. He taps his foot back and forth, keeping time to the jingle in his throat. The lavender-smelling woman touches her elbow to the side of John's coat as she reaches into her bag for a tissue. There's something in her eye, and she's looking at the ceiling of the elevator, at the tiny little escape hatch, holding the skin below her lashes so that the pink shows. John watches her. He hums. When John was 12 years old, he bought a plastic model of an eye for a science project. The model was the size of a bowling ball and came apart into soft pieces, pink and blue and red, with a sliding see-through lid over the iris. John made lists of diseases that blinded, chemicals and birth defects. He learned to read the alphabet in Braille. He set books out on the table and drew charts with magic markers and came in second place at the science fair, just behind a kinetic energy roller designed by Billy Joe. Later, John told a girl he fell in love with about it on the beach. He talked about her pupils, her cornea, her sclera and iris, her vitreous body and aqueous humor. She told him that when she was a child and something was caught in her eye, her mother, a nurse, would use her tongue to remove it. The elevator stops at the 14th floor. The doors open. Three people step out before the doors close again. The remaining passengers move away from John into the corners, and the lavender woman rearranges herself so that she is no longer touching anyone. She lowers her head, dabbing at the lashes with a tissue in her hand. John wonders if he should offer to lick it out. Red has been washing windows for 5 years. Before that, he was a house painter. And before that, he shingled roofs. And before that, he was a truck driver. And before that, he was a mover. He carried pianos on his back. The hammers hit the strings on each step down the stairs. And with the crushing weight of wood on top of him, Red felt it was not an instrument anymore, but all of his disappointments in life, groaning. His parents were killed in a car on the highway while Red was at a moving job, and that did it for him. He couldn't carry anything anymore. He met his wife at a truck stop. She was driving a refrigerated case full of turkey parts. He was pulling a load of Nabisco. They made love in the parking lot, his cab beneath a row of trees. She held onto the back of the driver's seat and he braced against the wheel, the smell of cigarettes on his fingertips. His hair covered her face in the dark. He parted it and pulled it aside and looked at her nose. It was round with a slight turn at the end, and he could see straight up inside. Before long, she was pregnant, and Red was climbing roofs. It was good to be working on homes, to be in one place with a woman who made him sandwiches. He opened his lunch bag each day and reached inside with the expectation of hard-boiled eggs, of tuna fish, of salami and cheese and grapes and cookies and small containers of applesauce. He pressed his back against the chimney, spread those items out on his napkin, and felt loved. After the baby came, they needed money, and he began washing skyscrapers. On his first trip over the edge, his knees had wobbled. "Don't look down," he'd been told. "It'll seem like miles." He didn't, but he could still see the reflection of what was behind him in the glass as he ran his squeegee across, and he could feel the wind shifting the scaffolding beneath his feet, and the metal of the railing seemed cold. No matter how long the sun had been shining on it, bugs ran into the windows occasionally. Bird. Red's daughter's ears never did grow in. She had a hearing aid to make up for a twisted canal, and there was no outer cartilage, just those tiny flaps, the beginnings of ears, a ridge of semicircles that her mother helped to hide with her hair. At the breakfast table that morning, his daughter had told him that she loved someone. "Me, I hope," Red said. She said yes, but she meant a different kind of love. She meant movie love. There was a boy in her first grade class who wore glasses, and she was making him a valentine. She'd already picked out the paper and was working on cutting a triangle for the front because he liked triangles. It made Red think of the fir tree. Too much damage had been done when he crushed it, so while his daughter was still in the incubator and maybe going to die, he'd torn the plant out by the roots. It hurt him to do it because he felt it might have saved him. When he fed it into the wood chipper, the machine choked. He pulled the pieces out, his hands sticky with sap, and he thought, "I love this so much. I love this more than anything." John steps out of the elevator with a lavender-smelling woman. They're standing on the same floor. He asks her, "Does she need any help? Can he do something for her? The speck, he can almost see it, seems to be caught in the corner of her eye. She's nearly crying, but she says no, reaches out for the wall, begins to guide herself, sliding her hands towards the door to the ladies' room. John's assistant has her hair piled on top of her head like an ice cream cone. He says hello to her, wiggles his eyebrows in the way that means coffee. She can tell that something's different. He notices that she notices, and he feels glad. He wants to shout, "I am different today," but instead he grips the handle of his office door, turns it. This office is a corner office with windows from ceiling to floor. And as he puts down his briefcase on the desk, he sees Red go flying past in one vertical movement. The man is more of a blur, really a flash of something large that makes John jump and think, "Did I see that?" and rush over to the window and press his forehead against it, looking down at the body twisting and turning. A piece of rope is trailing behind, attached to the man's back like the tail of a kite. John bangs his hands against the glass, thinking for a moment that he will be able to grab hold of it. There is nothing he can do, so he watches. John's legs ache as if he's been running. He sees the body flail along the side of the building and his stomach drops, the same queasy sensation of an elevator slipping before it catches itself, the suspension for a moment and the air it leaves behind. John leans into the frame of the window and realizes he's biting his lip. There's blood. He can taste it with his tongue. His secretary comes in behind and places a cup of coffee on his desk. "Here you are," she says, and John decides, right as he hears the sound of the cup and saucer clink together on the table, that he is going to wait outside the ladies' room until the lavender woman comes out. He's going to ask her to lunch, ride the elevator down with her, and if he's lucky, very, very lucky, she will marry him and his life will change and he will never have to come back to this. The owner of the kebab stand is sitting on a milk crate and is pressing a package of frozen meat to his face. He's looking up at the police officer and giving a description of the truck that destroyed his lunch cart when he sees Red's hard hat and pauses, thinking this is just a falling bird, just as one of the purple windbreaker tourists lifts the lens of her camera, focuses on a gargoyle, presses the shutter, and captures it. The hard hat is white. On the side it has the letters C-A-B-M, stamped in blue by the company Red works for, Chambers American Building and Maintenance. The hard hat is given to each man his first day on the job. It lands a full 15 seconds before Red does, in a fountain in front of the building. There is a woman on her way to an interview. She has three children at home and a husband who has disappeared, and now, suddenly, hears a shimmering explosion of water over her pink silk suit that leaves dark stains across her shoulder, blurs the ink on the copies of her resume, and flattens her hair. There's a boy delivering a plain cheese pizza. This pizza is on the way to a goodbye party for a receptionist who's worked at her company for 40 years, but now the thin cardboard box is drenched and the pizza boy turns his head and surprises lucky pennies wash onto the pavement. There is a dog walker with seven dogs, two dachshunds, a beagle, a golden retriever, a pit bull, a Burmese mountain dog, and a mutt. Bits of plastic fly through the air as the hard hat hits the bottom of the fountain. And the dog walker can't help himself. He lets go of every leash. He brings his arms across his face, and the dogs run for it, shaking the water off their bodies as they go breaking out in all directions. Red is still waiting for the safety catch. He wonders at the length of the rope. The wind is tearing at his legs, blowing so strongly against him that he thinks for a moment it's holding him up. Red stretches, then reaches his hand out, and it knocks against the side of the building, and he hears his fingers snap. The world is moving toward him, like someone opening their arms wider and wider until he can't see anything else. The second splash booms. Police, sent to investigate the lunch cart, pull out their yellow plastic tape and quickly circle the fountain. For good measure, they also place two sawhorses on the sidewalk. They radio for an ambulance and fire trucks. They spread out to find the dogs. The tourists finish taking pictures and climb onto their bus. The street vendors hide around the corner, their stolen goods wrapped up in blankets. The homeless men of the church slide their cardboard signs out of sight. The woman in the pink suit has removed her jacket. She holds it now in the breeze, waving it back and forth like a flag. She has 15 minutes to dry out. The owner of the kebab stand drops his frozen meat and stares at the scaffolding, still dangling at the top of the building. It is a tooth hanging on by a thread. The fire trucks arrive. They park on top of an abandoned case of plastic frogs, and the toys splinter across the street, all broken eyes and webbed toes. The firemen pile out, hook up hoses, roll their ladders. They ask what had happened and are told, cannonball. The dogs are collected. The pizza boy moves on. There are more pedestrians coming down the block, more taxis and buses and limousines and motorcycles. The police swing their arms and keep it all moving. Some people crane their necks at what is floating in the fountain. Others simply dodge around this new thing standing still.
Laurie Anderson reading Hannah Tinty's Milestones. Hannah Tinty is also the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the literary magazine One Story, and she joined me in the WNYC studios to talk about Milestones. Tell us about the process of creating this story. Were you listening to Miles Davis one day and thought to yourself, or what?
Well, actually, it sort of came as an assignment originally. I was approached by the editor of an anthology called Lit Riffs, and he was trying to get a bunch of writers to write work inspired by music that they enjoyed. And all I could think about was this song, which is, I'm a huge Miles Davis fan, and this is my favorite Miles Davis tune. And it always seemed to me a kind of love affair with New York City. It has that sort of energy and excitement. And the solos reminded me of how when you're walking down a busy New York street, how you sort of you start following someone with your eye and you think about their story, and then they kind of get lost in the crowd, and then you start watching someone else. And the way that there are all these inner stories happening within this sort of busy, crazy, exciting, energetic world.
Did you have the song playing on your machine while you sat writing?
I did, and the other thing I did was I broke down the story almost like a poem to try to duplicate the pattern of the music.
Yes, the rising and
the
falling.
The rising and the falling, and the solos is when I would go into the interior lives of the characters, and then when they would go back to the chorus, that's when I would go back to the street scene.
I'd like to hear more about that. So there you are seated with a music source at your left hand and your computer or your long yellow pad or however you write, seated on the other side of you. And was it a matter of constant revitalization, one for the other?
A little bit. It takes me a long time to write a short story. I have to ruminate and think it. Oftentimes it takes me many, many months. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was deciding who are these two main characters. Mm-hmm. One is a man who is falling from a skyscraper, and the other is a man rising in an elevator. And my idea was that they were passing each other vertically, where there was this horizontal craziness happening on the street.
I don't know what it says about America, but considering the craze about the hot television series Mad Men, the logo of which, the intro of which is a man falling from a skyscraper, I wonder if America is in some kind of decline and falling, and buildings falling are the symbol of what's been wrong since 9/11. It's fascinating to consider. How did that come to you as a central image for the piece?
I think it definitely stemmed from 9/11, actually. I wrote this story not too long after the towers fell, and I lived on Houston Street, so I was not right in the thick of things, but I was downtown and on the street and witness to everything that happened on that day, and it was... I was also in the area from 14th Street down. Afterwards, they cordoned it all off with tanks and everything. And also, my whole apartment building was, you know, got filtered with the dust. And it was a very intense day. And, and so it was staying with me and staying with me and staying with me. So I think partly the falling of Red in the story, it was a response to that. And I was thinking a lot about it because at the time I was working in one of those high rises, and I worked on like the 40th floor. That's really where that stemmed from. And I think I wanted to, at the end of the story, there's this sort of feeling of the city or the street sort of reaching up and embracing him as he's falling. And that's something I think happened to a lot of people who were living in New York at that time. Some people's response was to flee the city and move out.
Mm-hmm.
And other people's response, which was my response, is I never wanted to leave here again. I just felt completely rooted to the place in a much more emotional and strong way.
Mm. Author and editor Hannah Tinty. After a short break, we'll have a terrific story by Carson McCullers. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Calling all writers in our audience, announcing the 2011 Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Prize. This year's theme is stories set in restaurants and bars. The judge is the author Jennifer Egan, and the deadline is March 1st, 2011. All the details can be found at selectedshorts.org. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. For more information about the stories or the readers, please go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts. And by the way, we love to hear your questions, so please question us. Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 12, which you're hearing performed by Darren Erge on stage at Selected Shorts, is featured in Carson McCullough's story Wunderkind from her collection The Ballad of the Sad Café. The title Wunderkind is ironic. The piano student in this story is not a child prodigy. The story is read by the prodigious Kelly O'Hara, who won acclaim as Ensign Nellie Forbush in the Lincoln Center revival of the musical South Pacific.
She came into the living room, her music satchel plopping against her winter-stockinged legs, and her other arm weighted down with schoolbooks, and stood for a moment listening to the sounds from the studio, a soft procession of piano chords and the tuning of a violin. Then Mr. Bilderbach called out to her in his chunky, guttural tones, "That you, Benson?" As she jerked off her mitten, she saw that her fingers were twitching to the motions of the fugue she had practiced that morning. "Yes," she answered, "it's me." "I," the voice corrected. "Just a moment." She could hear Mr. Lafkowitz talking. His words spun out in a silky, unintelligible hum, a voice almost like a woman's, she thought, compared to Mr. Bilderbach's. Restlessness scattered her attention. She fumbled with her geometry book and Le Voyage de Monsieur Perrichon before putting them on the table. She sat down on the sofa and began to take her music from the satchel. Again, she saw her hands, the quivering tendons that stretched down from her knuckles, the sore fingertip capped with curled, dingy tape. The sight sharpened the fear that had begun to torment her for the past few months. Noiselessly, she mumbled a few phrases of encouragement to herself. A good lesson, like it used to be. Her lips closed as she heard the stolid sound of Mr. Bilderbach's footsteps across the floor of the studio and the creaking of the door as it slid open. For a moment, she had the peculiar feeling that during most of the 15 years of her life, she had been looking at the face and shoulders that jutted from behind the door in a silence disturbed only by the muted, blank plucking of a violin string. Mr. Bilderbach, her teacher, Mr. Bilderbach. The quick eyes behind the horn-rimmed glasses, the light, thin hair, and the narrow face beneath, the lips full and loose shut, and the lower one pink and shining from the bites of his teeth, the forked veins in his temples throbbing plainly enough to be observed across the room. "Aren't you a little early?" he asked, glancing at the clock on the mantelpiece that pointed to 12:05 for a month. "Joseph's in here. We're running over a little sonatina by someone he knows." "Good," she said, trying to smile. "I'll listen." She could see her fingers sinking powerless into a blur of piano keys. She felt tired, felt that if he looked at her much longer, her hands might start to tremble. He stood uncertain, halfway in the room. Sharply, his teeth pushed down on his bright, swollen lip. "Hungry, Benson?" he asked. "There's some apple cake, anamade, and milk." "I'll wait until afterwards," she said. "Thanks." "After you finish with a very fine lesson, eh?" He smiled, and it seemed to crumble at the corners. There was a sound from behind him in the studio, and Mr. Lafkowitz pushed at the other panel of the door and stood beside him. "Francis," he said, smiling, "how is the work coming now?" Without meaning to, Mr. Lafkowitz always made her feel clumsy and overgrown. He was such a small man himself, with a weary look when he was not holding his violin. His eyebrows curved high above his sallow Jewish face as though asking a question, but the lids of his eyes drowsed languorous and indifferent. Today he seemed distracted. She watched him come into the room for no apparent purpose, holding his pearl-tipped bow in his still fingers, slowly gliding the white horsehair through a chalky piece of rosin. His eyes were sharp, bright slits today, and the linen handkerchief that flowed down his collar darkened the shadows beneath them. "I gather you're doing a lot now," smiled Mr. Lafkowitz, although she had not answered the question. She looked at Mr. Bilderbach. He turned away. His heavy shoulders pushed the door open wide so that the late afternoon sun came through the window of the studio and shafted yellow over the dusty living room. Behind her teacher, she could see the squat, long piano, the window, and the bust of Brahms. "No," she said to Mr. Lafkowitz, "I'm doing terribly." Her thin fingers flipped at the pages of her music. "I don't know what's the matter," she said, looking at Mr. Bilderbach's stooped muscular back that stood tense and listening. Mr. Lafkowitz smiled. "There are times, I suppose, when one..." A harsh chord sounded from the piano. "Don't you think we'd better get on with this?" asked Mr. Bilderbach. "Immediately," said Mr. Lafkowitz, giving the bow one more scrape before starting toward the door. She could see him pick up his violin from the top of the piano. He caught her eye and lowered the instrument. "You've seen the picture of Heima." Her fingers curled tight over the sharp corner of the satchel. "What picture?" "One of Heima in the musical courier, there on the table, inside the top cover." The sonatina began. Discordant yet somehow simple, empty but with a sharp-cut style of its own. She reached for the magazine and opened it. There Heima was, in the left-hand corner, holding his violin with his fingers hooked down over the strings for a pizzicato, with his dark serge knickers strapped neatly beneath his knees, a sweater and rolled collar. It was a bad picture. Although it was snapped in profile, his eyes were cut around towards the photographer, and his finger looked as though it would pluck the wrong string. He seemed suffering to turn around towards the picture-taking apparatus. He was thinner. His stomach did not poke out now. But he hadn't changed much in 6 months. Heima Israelsky, talented young violinist, snapped while working in his teacher's studio on Riverside Drive. Young Master Israelsky, who will soon celebrate his 15th birthday, has been invited to play the Beethoven Concerto. That morning, after she had practiced from 6 until 8, her dad had made her sit down at the table with the family for breakfast. She hated breakfast. It gave her a sick feeling afterward. She would rather wait and get 4 chocolate bars with her 20 cents lunch money and munch them during school, bringing up little morsels from her pocket under cover of her handkerchief, stopping dead when the silver paper rattled. But this morning, her dad had put a fried egg on her plate, and she had known that if it burst, so that the slimy yellow oozed over the white, she would cry. And that had happened. The same feeling was upon her now. Gingerly, she laid the magazine back on the table and closed her eyes. The music in the studio seemed to be urging violently and clumsily for something that was not to be had. After a moment, her thoughts drew back from Heima and the concerta and the picture and hovered around the lesson once more. She slid over on the sofa until she could see plainly into the studio, the two of them playing, peering at the notations on the piano, lustfully drawing out all that was there. She could not forget the memory of Mr. Bilderbach's face as he had stared at her a moment ago, her hands still twitching unconsciously to the motions of the fugue, closed over her bony knees. Tired she was, and with a circling, sinking-away feeling like the one that often came to her just before she dropped off to sleep on the nights when she had overpracticed, like those weary half-dreams that buzzed and carried her out into their own whirling space. A wunderkind, a wunderkind, a wunderkind! The syllables would come out rolling in the deep German way, roar against her ears, and then fall to a murmur. Along with the faces circling, swelling out in distortion, diminishing to pale blobs, Mr. Bilderbach, Mr. Bilderbach, Heima, Mr. Lafkowitz, around and around in a circle revolving to the guttural Wunderkind, Mr. Bilderbach looming large in the middle of the circle, his face urging with the others around him. Phrases of music seesawing crazily, notes she had been practicing falling over each other like a handful of marbles dropped downstairs. Bach, Debussy, Prokofiev, Brahms, timed grotesquely to the far-off throb of her tired body and the buzzing circle. Sometimes, when she had not worked more than 3 hours or had stayed out from school, the dreams were not so confused. The music soared clearly in her mind, and quick, precise little memories would come back, clear as the sissy Age of Innocence picture Haima had given her after their joint concert was over. A Wunderkind. That was what Mr. Bilderbach had called her when, at 12, she came to him. Older pupils had repeated the word. Not that he had ever said it to her. Benshin. She had a plain American name, but he never used it except when her mistakes were enormous. Benshin, he would say. I know, it must be terrible, carrying all the time in that head, in that thick head. Poor, poor Benshin. Mr. Bilderbach's father had been a Dutch violinist. His mother was from Prague. He had been born in this country and had spent his youth in Germany. So many times she had wished that she had not been born and brought up in just Cincinnati. How do you say cheese in German, Mr. Bilderbach? What is Dutch for I don't understand you? The first day she came to the studio, after she played the whole second Hungarian Rhapsody from memory, the room graying with twilight, his face had as he leaned over the piano, "Now we begin all over," he said that first day. It, playing music, is more than cleverness. If a 12-year-old girl's fingers cover so many keys to a second, that means nothing. He tapped his broad chest and his forehead with his stubby hand. Here and here. You are old enough to understand that. He lighted a cigarette and gently blew the first exhalation above her head. And work, work, work. We will start now with these Bach inventions and these little Schumann pieces. His hands moved again, this time to jerk the cord of the lamp behind her and point to the music. I will show you how I wished this practice. Listen carefully now. She had been at the piano for almost 3 hours and was very tired. His deep voice sounded as though it had been straying inside her for a long time. She wanted to reach out and touch his muscle-flexed finger that pointed out the phrases, wanted to feel the gleaming gold band ring in the strong, hairy back of his hand. She had lessons Tuesday after school and on Saturday afternoons. Often she stayed when the Saturday lesson was finished for dinner, and then spent the night and took the streetcar home the next morning. Mrs. Bilderbach liked her. In her calm, almost dumb way. She was much different from her husband. She was quiet and fat and slow. When she wasn't in the kitchen cooking the rich dishes they both loved, she seemed to spend all her time in their bed upstairs, reading magazines or just looking with a half smile at nothing. When they had married in Germany, she had been a lead singer. She didn't sing anymore. She said it was her throat. When he would call her in from the kitchen to listen to a pupil, she would always smile and say that it was good, very good. When Francis was 13, it came to her one day that the Bilderbachs had no children. It seemed strange. Once she had been back in the kitchen with Mrs. Bilderbach when he had come striding in from the studio, tense with anger at some pupil who had annoyed him. His wife stood stirring the thick soup until his hand groped out and rested on her shoulder. Then she turned, stood placid, while he folded his arms about her and buried his sharp face in the white, nerveless flesh of her neck. They stood that way without moving. And then his face jerked back suddenly, the anger diminished to a quiet inexpressiveness, and he returned to the studio. After she had started with Mr. Bilderbach and didn't have time to see anything of the people at high school, Haima had been the only friend of her own age. He was Mr. Lofkowitz's pupil and would come with him to Mr. Bilderbach's on evenings when she would be there. They would listen to their teachers playing, and often they themselves went over chamber music together, Mozart sonatas or Bach. A Wunderkind. A Wunderkind. Haima was a wunderkind. He and she, then. Jaime had been playing the violin since he was 4. He didn't have to go to school. Mr. Lofkowitz's brother, who was crippled, used to teach him geometry and European history and French verbs in the afternoon. When he was 13, he had as fine a technique as any violinist in Cincinnati. Everyone said so. But playing the violin must be easier than the piano. She knew it must be. Jaime always seemed to smell of corduroy pants and the food he had eaten and rosin. Half of the time, too, his hands were dirty around the knuckles and the cuffs of his shirt peeped out dingily from the sleeves of his sweater. She always watched his hands when he played. Thin, only at the joints, with the hard little blobs of flesh bulging over the short-cut nails and the babyish-looking crease that showed so plainly in his bowing wrist. In the dreams, as when she was awake, she could remember the concert only in a blur. She had not known it was unsuccessful for her until months after. True, the papers had praised Jaime more than her, but he was much shorter than she. When they stood together on the stage, he came only to her shoulders, and that made a difference with people, she knew. Also, there was the matter of the sonata they played together, the Bloch. No, I don't think that would be appropriate, Mr. Bilderbach had said when the Bloch was suggested to end the program. Now, that John Powell thing, the sonata Virginianesque, now. Now, she hadn't understood then. She wanted to be the Bloch just as much as Mr. Lofkowitz and Jaime. Mr. Bilderbach had given in. Later, after the reviews had said that she lacked the temperament for that type of music, after they called her playing thin and lacking in feeling, she felt cheated. That oi oi stuff, said Mr. Bilderbach, crackling the newspapers at her. Not for you, Bündchen. Leave all that to the Jaimes and the Witzes and the Skis. A wunderkind. No matter what the paper said, that was what he had called her. Why was it that Jaime had done so much better at the concert than she? At school sometimes, when she was supposed to be watching someone do a geometry problem on the blackboard, the question would twist knife-like inside her. She would worry about it in bed, and even sometimes when she was supposed to be concentrating at the piano. It wasn't just the Bloch or her not being Jewish. Not entirely. It wasn't that Jaime didn't have to go to school and he had begun his training so early either. It was... Once she thought she knew. Play the Fantasia and Fugue, Mr. Bilderbach had demanded one evening a year ago, after he and Mr. Lofkowitz had finished reading some music together. The Bach, as she played, seemed to her well done. From the tail of her eye, she could see the calm, pleased expression on Mr. Bilderbach's face, see his hands rise climactically from the chair arms and then sink down loose and satisfied when the high points of the phrases had been passed successfully. She stood up from the piano when it was over, swallowing to loosen the bands that the music seemed to have drawn around her throat and chest, but... Francis, Mr. Lofkowitz had said then, suddenly looking at her with his thin mouth curved and his eyes almost covered by their delicate lids. Do you know how many children Bach had? A good many, 20-some-odd? Well, then. The corners of his smile edged themselves gently into his pale face. He could not have been so cold then. Mr. Bilderbach was not pleased. His guttural effulgence of German words had kindled in it somewhere. Mr. Lofkowitz raised his eyebrows. She had caught the point easily enough, but she felt no deception in keeping her face blank and immature, because that was the way Mr. Bilderbach wanted her to look. Yet such things had nothing to do with it. Nothing very much, at least, for she would grow older. Mr. Bilderbach understood that, and even Mr. Lofkowitz had not meant just what he said. In the dreams, Mr. Bilderbach's face loomed out and contracted in the center of the whirling circle, the lips surging softly, the veins in his temples insisting. But sometimes, before she slept, there were such clear memories, as when she pulled a hole in the heel of her stocking down so that her shoe would hide it. Bündchen, Bündchen! And bringing Mrs. Bilderbach's workbasket in and showing her how it should be darned and not gathered around in a lumpy heap. And the time she graduated from junior high. What do you wear? asked Mrs. Bilderbach the Sunday morning at breakfast when she told them about how they had practiced to march into the auditorium. An evening dress my cousin had last year. Ah, Bündchen, he said, circling his warm coffee cup with his heavy hands, looking up at her with wrinkles around his laughing eyes. I bet I know what Bündchen wants. He insisted. He would not believe her when she explained that she honestly didn't care. She didn't care at all. Like this, Anna, he said, pushing his napkin across the table and mincing to the other side of the room, swishing his hips, rolling up his eyes behind his horn-rimmed glasses. The next Saturday afternoon, after her lessons, he took her to the department stores downtown. His thick fingers smoothed over the filmy nets and crackling taffetas that the saleswoman unwound from their bolts. He held colors to her face, cocking his head to one side. And he selected pink. Shoes, he remembered, too. He liked best some white kid pumps. They seemed a little like old lady shoes to her, and the Red Cross label in the instep had a charity look, but it really didn't matter at all. When Mrs. Bilderbach began to cut out the dress and fit it onto her with pins, he interrupted his lessons to stand by and suggest ruffles around the hips and neck and a fancy rosette on the shoulder. The music was coming along nicely then. Dresses and commencement and such made no difference. Nothing mattered much except playing the music as it must be played, bringing out the thing that must be in her, practicing, practicing, playing so that Mr. Bilderbach's face lost some of its urging look. Putting the thing into her music that Myra Hess had, that Yehudi Menuhin, even Haima. What had begun to happen to her 4 months ago? The notes began springing out with a glib, dead intonation. Adolescence, she thought. Adolescence. Some kids played with promise and worked until, like her, the least little thing would just start them crying and worn out with trying to get the thing across, the longing thing they felt. Something queer began to happen. But not she. See, she was like Haima. She had to be. She... Once it was there for sure. And you didn't lose things like that. A wunderkind. A wunderkind. Of her, he said it, rolling the words in the sure, deep German way. And in the dreams, even deeper, more certain than ever, with his face looming out at her and the longing phrases of music mixed in with the zooming, circling round and round. A wunderkind, a wunderkind. This afternoon, Mr. Bilderbach did not show Mr. Lafkowitz to the front door, as he usually did. He stayed at the piano, softly pressing one solitary note. Listening, Francis watches the violinist wind his scarf about his pale throat. A good picture of Haima, she said, picking up her music. I got a letter from him a couple of months ago, telling me about hearing Schnabel and Huberman and about Carnegie Hall and things to eat at the Russian Tea Room. To put off going into the studio a moment longer, she waited until Mr. Lafkowitz was ready to leave and then stood behind him as he opened the door. The frosty cold outside cut into the room. It was growing late and the air was seeped with the pale yellow of winter twilight. When the door swung to on its hinges, the house seemed darker and more silent than ever before she had known it to be. As she went into the studio, Mr. Bilderbach got up from the piano and silently watched her settle herself at the keyboard. Well, Bündchen, he said, this afternoon we are going to begin all over. Start from scratch. Forget the last few months. He looked as though he were trying to act a part in a movie. His solid body swayed from toe to heel. He rubbed his hands together and even smiled in a satisfied movie way. Then suddenly he thrust his manner brusquely aside. His heavy shoulders slouched and he began to run through the stack of music she had brought in. The Bach, no, not yet, he murmured. The Beethoven, yes. The Variation Sonata, Opus 26. The keys of the piano hemmed her in, stiff and white and dead-seeming. Wait a minute, he said, He stood in the curve of the piano, elbows propped, and looked at her. "Today I expect something from you. Now this sonata, it's the first Beethoven sonata you ever worked on. Every note is under control, technically. You have nothing to cope with but the music. Only music now. That's all you think about." He rustled through the pages of her volume until he found the place. Then he pulled his teaching chair halfway across the room, turned it around, and seated himself, straddling the back with his legs. For some reason, she knew, this position of his usually had a good effect on her performance. But today, she felt that she would notice him from the corner of her eye and be disturbed. His back was stiffly tilted, his legs looked tense. The heavy volume before him seemed to balance dangerously on the chair back. "Now we begin," he said with a peremptory dart of his eyes in her direction. Her hands rounded over the keys and then sank down. The first notes were too loud, and the other phrases followed dryly. Arrestingly, his hand rose up from the score. "Wait! Think a minute what you're playing. What's the beginning marked? Andante? Right. Don't drag it into an adagio, then, and play deeply into the keys. Don't snatch it off shallowly that way. A graceful, deep-toned andante." She tried again. Her hands seemed separate from the music that was in her. "Listen," he interrupted, "which of these variations dominates the whole?" "The dirge," she answered. "Then prepare for that. This is an andante, but it's not salon stuff like you just played it. Start out softly, piano, and make it swell out just before the arpeggio. Make it warm and dramatic. And down here, where it's marked dolce, make the counter melody sing out. You know all that. We've gone over all that side of it before. Now play it. Feel it as Beethoven wrote it down. Feel the tragedy and restraint." She could not stop looking at his hands. They seemed to rest tentatively on the music, ready to fly up as a stop signal as soon as she would begin, the gleaming flash of his ring calling to her to halt. "Mr. Bilderbach, maybe if you would let me play on through the first variation without stopping, I could do better." "I won't interrupt," he said. Her pale face leaned over too close to the keys. She played through the first part and, obeying a nod from him, began the second. There were no flaws that jarred on her, but the phrases shaped from her fingers before she had put into them the meaning she felt. When she had finished, he looked up from the music and began to speak with dull bluntness. "I hardly heard those harmonic fillings in the right hand. And incidentally, this part was supposed to take on intensity, develop the foreshadowings that were supposed to be inherent in this first part. Go on with the next one, though." She wanted to start it with subdued viciousness and progress to a feeling of deep, swollen sorrow. Her mind told her that. But her hands seemed to gum in the keys like limp macaroni, and she could not imagine the music as it should be. When the last note had stopped vibrating, he closed the book and deliberately got up from the chair. He was moving his lower jaw from side to side, and between his open lips she could glimpse the pink, healthy lane to his throat and his strong, smoke-yellowed teeth. He laid the Beethoven gingerly on top of the rest of her music and propped his elbows on the smooth black piano top once more. "No," he said simply, looking at her. Her mouth began to quiver. I can't help it. Suddenly he strained his lips into a smile. "Listen, Bennchen," he began in a new, forced voice, "you still play the harmonious blacksmith, don't you? I told you not to drop it from your repertoire." "Yes," she said, I practice it now and then." His voice was the one he used for children. "It was among the first things we worked on together, remember? So strongly you used to play it, like a real blacksmith's daughter. You see, Bennchen, I know you so well, as if you were my own girl. I know what you have. I've heard you play so many things beautifully. You used to..." He stopped in confusion and inhaled from his pulpy stub of cigarette. The smoke drowsed out from his pink lips and clung in a gray mist around her lank hair and childish forehead. "Make it happy and simple," he said, switching on the lamp behind her and stepping back from the piano. For a moment, he stood just inside the bright circle the light made. Then impulsively, he squatted down to the floor. "Vigorous," he said. She could not stop looking at him. Sitting on one heel with the other foot resting squarely before him for balance, the muscles of his strong thighs straining under the cloth of his trousers, his back straight, his elbows staunchly propped on his knees. "Simply now," he repeated with a gesture of his fleshy hands. "Think of the blacksmith, working out in the sunshine all day, working easily and undisturbed." She could not look down at the piano. The light brightened the hairs on the backs of his outspread hands and made the lenses of his glasses glitter. "All of it," he urged, "now!" She felt that the marrows of her bones were hollow and there was no blood left in her. Her heart that had been springing against her chest all afternoon felt suddenly dead. She saw it gray and limp and shriveled at the edges like an oyster. His face seemed to throb out in space before her, come closer with the lurching motion in the veins of his temples. In retreat, she looked down at the piano. Her lips shook like jelly, and a surge of noiseless tears made the white keys blur in a watery line. "I can't," she whispered. "I don't know why, but I just can't. Can't anymore." His tense body slackened, and holding his hand to his side, he pulled himself up. She clutched her music and hurried past him. Her coat, the mittens, the galoshes, the school books, and the satchel he had given her on her birthday, all from the silent room that was hers, quickly, before he would have time to say anything. As she passed through the vestibule, she could not help but see his hands, held out from his body that leaned against the studio door, relaxed and purposeless. The door shut to, firmly. Dragging her books and satchel, she stumbled down the stone steps, turned in the wrong direction, and hurried down the street that had become confused with noise and bicycles and the games of other children.
Kelly O'Hara read Wunderkind by Carson McCullers. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The president of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott, and the artistic director of Symphony Space is Laura Kaminsky. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2010 by Richard Russo. Additional support has been provided by Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is also supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for this program comes from this station and public radio international stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.